leave the country. This is causing serious problems in places where they depend most on this supply, like the Middle East and Africa. There's so many ripple effects from the war, but it's hard to overstate just how big the impact of the grain crisis is. Along with the shortages, you've also got the rising prices of fertilizers and fuel, as well as natural disasters due to climate change like drought, which has only further worsened the situation globally. And now UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of a global food crisis as the West's anti-Russia stance is creating obstacles to the flow of Russian products and fertilizers to the world. Guterres said that the global food crisis triggered by the Ukraine conflict looms over the world. The UN chief says the West's sanctions on Russia have exacerbated the poor situation of the global economy.
They are trying to use all kinds of arguments. Some are, real, based on something. Some are absolutely spurious and based on nothing, to somehow get the public opinion against Russia. And that concerns this story of grain. You know, Russia and other countries produce, you know, much more grain than Ukraine. So the very idea that Africa will somehow starve, not because of misguided Western policies, not because of the prices which, you know, West commands, but because five boats of grain which cannot leave Odessa, it's a joke. There were tons of possibilities for even that grain to go, and there is endless amount of possibilities to get grain from Russia, from France, and so on. So that was all mobilized by Ukraine to somehow turn the opinions that it's like all Russia fault. You know, children are dying in Africa, Russian fault, isn't it? And unfortunately, Antonio Guterres, rather than approaching the whole thing objectively, coming to the, territory, exploring it, asking questions, saying, what can we do? He more or less channels the information which is given to him by Ukraine.
But despite this, only a few nations seem to be pushing for diplomatic efforts in an attempt to restore the global supply chains, and other countries, mainly the US and its allies, continue their anti-Russia stance, pushing ahead with their foreign policy. The impact of the West's war on Russia through sanctions can be felt globally. Global supply chains have been disrupted, fears of food shortages are rising, and countries' economies have also taken a hit. But despite the heavy costs incurred by the people worldwide, the US and many European leaders seem to have set their eyes on pushing ahead with their sanctions policy instead of opting for diplomacy. Russia is a major exporter of potash, ammonia, urea, and other soil nutrients, and the supply of all these fertilizers, which are necessities for efficient production of corn, soy, rice, and wheat, has been heavily disrupted as a result of Western sanctions on Russia. A clear example of this would be Brazilian farmers who are forced to use less fertilizers considering the shortages created in their country. In some African countries, farmers are reverting to using manure to nourish their crops. And in North America, some farmers have stockpiled fertilizers for the 2023 season in anticipation of higher prices. Meanwhile, in the United States, fertilizer bills are expected to jump 12% this year, and that's according to the American Farm Bureau Federation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA data.
No, I think the whole war is definitely, you know, war in general is should be avoided. But this one is just very cynical calculation. Somehow the leadership of NATO, leadership in Washington, decided that it's a win-win situation. A, we, you know, get opinion against Russia. B, we'll get sanctions against Russia, which will benefit us, our gas companies, our oil companies, our military companies. And see, it even has a chance to weaken Russia, which is like our enemy, to weaken Russia militarily. So they're pumping Ukraine with military forces. They're trying to push them to the battlefield. In the battlefield, Russians are killed, Ukrainians are killed in great numbers, while, you know, leadership, Ukrainian leadership buys fancy cars for themselves and they don't send their children to the front. They send some poor people to the front. So this is just exercising the bloodshed, out of which many people hope to, get some economic benefit.
But while standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. Instead of following diplomacy similar to Turkey in an attempt to solve the ongoing crisis, the West continues to follow its warmongering aspirations and further sanction Russia.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear listeners, the audience of your very favorite program, For a Better Life, you're listening to IRB English Radio. This is Asma, your friend, and we're going to have a heart-to-heart whisper regarding the literature of Ashura. Well, previously on For a Better Life, we talked about the themes of literary pieces regarding the Battle of Karbala. We said that through these pieces of poetry and prose, we'll let our soul into a spiritual journey that takes us to the sublime. That is the truth. We talked about different themes, different characteristics that are depicted in these literary pieces. The characteristics of the companion of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his true followers, which is going to count as a model for us who are living in an age far away from that story, far away from the event of Karbala and its tragic, epic story. We said that we have to stay brave. Among those characteristics, we counted some of the very important ones and the prominent ones. That is the purity of the heart, stay brave, and practice patience, obedience, and also we talked about the insight that we should have in our heart. Now, aside from poetry and prose, there's another form that comes to the help of literature and creates great masterpieces regarding the Battle of Karbala. As a Muslim who lives in an Islamic country, it's a common thing to know about Taziyeh. Not many people are lucky enough to witness these great plays ever since their childhood. Since it's been quite some sessions that we've been discussing literature of Ashura, I found it really disrespectful not to mention this form of art that is devoted to the Battle of Ashura. Now let's go to it step by step. First, let's talk about the fact that what is Taziyeh? The word itself means condolence or mourning. Now, as a form of art, it is applied to a certain type of plays that deal with the Battle of Karbala and its tragic story from the beginning to the end. As I just told you, It is a form of play that is devoted to Battle of Ashura. Mostly it deals with the topics and stories that went on in the day of Ashura, before that or after that, the arrival of Imam Hussein alayhi salam with his caravan to Karbala. Then after that, the departure of his family members to Damascus, to Kufa, firstly to Kufa and then to Damascus. And I will give you a picture of what happens through Taziyah. They are more humble and modest, you know, because the people who are acting, I mean, the actors are maybe even amateurs. They pick the actors from ordinary people. They are not very much like real actors. They have a script. There are two types of Taziyah, by the way. Some of them are silent ones that are accompanied by musical instruments that also are devoted to Ashura. And they have this sad theme behind them. So the other form of these plays is the one that that has got a context, a text, a script. And the actors will memorize their texts, their scripts, and then they would recite it in front of everyone. Sometimes these plays are performed on a stage, and sometimes they are just performed on a side of a street, on a corner of a street, or in a square somewhere that plenty of people could stand on their feet and watch what is happening in that play. The interesting part is that the stage is not decorated with too much of things. Actually, there might be some of them that are fully decorated, but most of them that are very into real life, and they are so tangible and very much like done by ordinary people, they do not have too much of decoration. Just a few of these decors and ornaments that differentiate between the two sides of the battle. It is actually symbolic because they pick the color red for the people on the wrong side, and the color green for the people on the side of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So the kids and plenty much of kids are dressed in green, and you actually cannot see their faces. Their face is also covered by a sort of fabric or something. So even the role of the women is going to be played by male actors.
Abbas and Amara. Dard mandam shafa bio asabat
bons dogoz shat
bedeh ma ra javab emshe
avaz bizay khurushaya و یا بانگ زرف هر دم پیاپی بس به گوش آید
پیپل would sit on side of the street or just on their feet. There is no place for sitting. And then they would behold these plays. Just like the other sorts of plays, when you go through a visual experience, you would have these deep passions and emotions lurking inside your heart and then coming into the surface. And then this situation of catharsis that we have it in literature and drama happens to you. That is the process of purification, that is emotional release. It would happen to you. Just as the one who is beholding that play, you would sympathize with those little kids and with all the women who are going through that much of brutality that is done to them by the wrong side of the battle. Just as you are standing there, there is a moment of silence that comes to you. And then in that very moment, you start to think and ponder deeply upon the reasons of the Battle of Karbala, of why Imam Hussein alayhi salam has put it on himself to come all this long way to bring all his family into a land in which he is going to be martyred and his family members are going to be chained in shackles and the women are going to experience a life that no creature in the human history has ever experienced before them. So the type of brutality that's been shared in there in the battlefield of Karbala has got no other equivalent in the history. That is why it makes you so sorrowful. It makes your heart filled with anguish. You know, it makes you just feel like you are in the middle of that battlefield. Actually, the brutal scenes are not depicted. It's just a symbolic sort of depiction of what happened in the Battle of Karbala. There are some pictures of these sort of taziyeh, or what we call as mourning plays that are devoted to Ashura in the internet. So if you just type that name, Google it, then you could find plenty much of pictures and photos of this historical sort of play. May Allah bless and protect you. Thank you for listening.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash. I share, he knows. Allah knows.
In the limelight.
Whether Israel assassinates journalists such as Shirin Abu Aghla, imprisons and tortures leaders of the resistance, demolishes homes and destroys farmlands, raids, plunders and bombs Gaza, it cannot subdue Palestine's spirited struggle to free itself from the yoke of Zionist brutality, says Iqbal Jassad, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Message of Palestinian resistance is clear. No surrender to apartheid Israel. Here's the story. Pariah regimes are known to decay until they turn lifeless. South Africa, under white minority rule, is a perfect example. It has stagnated both in morality and authority, despite claiming staunch Christian values and nuclear power. The Zionist regime faces a similar ignominious end, as a replica of South African National Party's apartheid ideology coupled with racist Zionism and underpinned by settler colonialism, the fabricated regime of Israel has reached the end of an inglorious reign. Just as South Africa in its final throes committed horrendous atrocities in the foolish belief that the slaughter of anti-apartheid opponents would allow it to sustain its oppressive rule, the fabricated regime of Israel today is caught in the same rut. The regime of Israel naively believes that possessing nukes along with a powerful army replenished with sophisticated weapons and having the back of the United States regime makes it invincible. The go-to-hell approach whereby it conducts daily rituals of cold-blooded assassinations has all the hallmarks of a rotten regime. Brute military force to punish Palestinians for daring to demand fundamental human rights epitomizes medieval tyranny. As successive Israeli regime war criminals keep repeating blunders in pursuit of misplaced Jewish supremacy, they clearly are blinded by hate and prejudice against the indigenous Palestinian population of Muslims and Christians. Foolhardy and stubborn adherence to policies that are not only in conflict with universally accepted norms of human rights, but also at odds with divinely inspired religious and spiritual values is a mirror reflection of the old South Africa. Unlike rational understanding and acceptance of the inevitability of mistakes, having an ability to come back to haunt, the fabricated regime of Israel persists doggedly to discriminate, oppress, and punish Palestinians with gusto and impunity. 4 decades ago, in 1982, the fabricated regime of Israel miscalculated, as it continues to do, by thinking that driving fighters out of Beirut into exile in Tunisia would annihilate Palestinian resistance. In fact, Menachem Begin, the big terrorist responsible for genocidal acts resulting in ethnic cleansing, suggested during a speech as Prime Minister to the Knesset during the PLO's expulsion that the fabricated regime of Israel was on the verge of enjoying 40 years of peace. Begin cited the biblical passage, "And the land was quiet for 40 years," saying it might well apply to Israel now that the northern border threat had been dealt with. Exactly a repeat of South Africa's false paradigm, which the Zionist regime leaders have followed since 1948, the narrative that applying military force will keep the colonial entity safe and peaceful. The blunder of the fake regime of Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon not only failed to bring peace, it resulted in 40 years of painful consequences. According to a Haaretz report, Zionist leadership failed to recognize and acknowledge that resistance to Israeli regime occupation in general and by the Palestinian movement in particular was much bigger than the PLO. To its cost, the Zionist regime's war on Lebanon saw the emergence of Hezbollah, the legendary anti-terrorist movement, a potent adversary of the colonial regime's invasion and horrendous massacres in Sabra and Shatila, among others. And all the while, in the occupied Palestinian territories, grievous atrocities committed by the Zionist regime against a defenseless population sowed the seeds of the First Intifada in 1987. And all the while, in the occupied Palestinian territories, grievous atrocities committed by the Zionist regime against a defenseless population sowed the seeds of the First Intifada in 1987 and the rise of the Islamic resistance movement Hamas. The Zionist regime's calculation of weakening the PLO by exiling Arafat backfired as dismally as apartheid South Africa's war on the liberation movements, imprisoning leaders of freedom struggles such as Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Ahmed Kathrada, Robert Sobukwe, and cold-blooded execution of Steve Biko, Ahmed Timol, and many more personnel failed to secure apartheid's illegal reign. whether the fabricated regime of Israel assassinates journalists such as Shirin Abu Aqile, imprisons and tortures leaders of resistance, demolishes homes and destroys farmlands, raids, plunders and bombs Gaza, it cannot subdue Palestine's spirited struggle to free itself from the yoke of Zionist brutality, as South Africa learned, so will the fabricated regime of Israel, that wielding military power to eliminate as many targets at it once will not attain security nor sustain any of Zionism's ill-gotten gains. Islamic Jihad's successful thwarting of the Zionist regime's unprovoked onslaught in Gaza has allowed it to emerge victorious and an important component of Palestinian resistance. Alongside Hamas and Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad has entrenched itself as a force capable to deter Israeli regime's aggression. More importantly, the message it proclaims is that the Palestinian people will neither retreat nor surrender.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the charitable nature of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And in today's lesson, we're talking about the charitable nature of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Now, as we're talking about the charitable nature of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam, I would like to report to you a short story that took place during his time that shows that His Eminence Al-Imam Al-Hussein was really a charitable person. A traveler came to Al-Imam Al-Hussein and saluted him and told him about his needs and said, "I have heard from your grandfather that he used to say, whenever you have any need, ask it from me. Ask it from one of the four persons, from a noble Arab or the benevolent or the charitable who gives happily or the people of Quran or one having an elegant face. However, the Arab has received nobility only through your grandfather, and as for benevolence, it is your custom. And as for the Quran, it was revealed in your house, an elegant face. I heard the messenger of Allah say, when you desire to see me, just look at the faces of Hassan and Hussein." Trying to say that he really sees so many good qualities in Al-Imam Al-Hussein. Now, His Eminence Imam Hussein asked him, "What do you want?" The traveler wrote his requirement on the sand, and His Eminence Imam Hussein said, "I heard my father say that goodness is proportionate to divine recognition. So I want to ask you three questions. If you reply to one of them, I shall give you one third of what I have. If you reply two questions, two thirds of what I possess shall be yours. If you reply to all three questions, all I have shall be yours, while a pass has just arrived from Iraq." So the traveler said, "Go on and ask the questions. There is no power and strength except from Allah. We'll come back in a few minutes and I'll complete the story. Thank you for listening."
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
السلام على ضيك يا أبا عبد الله
وعلى أرواح.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. Now, we are talking about the charitable nature of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam, and we were reporting about a short story that took place during his time, whereby a traveler came to Imam al-Hussein and asked for his help. Now, Imam al-Hussein just told him to answer a few questions and he will help him whatever he needs. In fact, he will give him half or even all of his wealth if he continues and answer the questions. Now, when he was asked the questions, the traveler said, "Go on and ask the questions. There's no power and strength except from Allah." The Imam Hussein alayhi salam asked the traveler, "What is the best deed?" Then the traveler answered, "Believe in God. If you have a belief in God, that's the best deed that you can do." Then Imam asked him, "What is the way of salvation for any man, for a man?" Then the traveler answered, "The reliance and having trust on God." And then Imam asked him, "What is that bestows beauty to man?" The man replied, "Knowledge accompanied with forbearance." "What if he does not have? What if he does not have knowledge?" That is, Imam asked him. "Then he should have wealth accompanied with generosity." "What if he does not have it? What if he doesn't have the wealth?" "Then he should have penury accompanied with patience." He said, "What if he does not have that also? A bolt of lightning should strike him from the sky and burn him up." The holy Imam smiled and handed him the pass. He gave him what he needed just by asking him a few questions, and the guy answered them very nicely. This is a short story showing us the charitable nature of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam. Dear brothers and sisters, we really can learn a lot from the life of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam. We see how charitable he was and how he lived with people. Some of them, he didn't even know who they were. They just came to him, seeked for help, and he helped them. This is how Aba Abdullah lived with people. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Until next episode, inshallah, fi amanillah, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en-islam-page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. new version of the 2025-2030 dietary guidelines published by the US government doesn't mention food's role in the climate crisis at all. Climate groups say this is an abdication of responsibility, with Americans feeling the effects of a warming planet more than ever. We'll prepare for you an article written by Marina Bolotnikova. The piece is titled How US Government Diet Guidelines Ignore the Climate Crisis. To keep the climate habitable, most scientists agree that switching to renewable energy alone isn't enough. Americans also need to change the way they eat. Environmental and public health advocates are pushing a new strategy to help get there, including climate breakdown in the official US dietary guidelines, which shape what goes into billions of meals eaten across the country every year. Every 5 years, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services jointly publish a new version of the guidelines. They form the basis for the public-facing eating guide, My Plate, formerly My Pyramid, as well as many government-backed meal programs such as National School Lunch. Historically, these guidelines have narrowly focused on human nutrition, but some are now saying they should be expanded to incorporate climate considerations as well. The current 150-page edition for 2020 through to 2025 doesn't mention food's role in the climate crisis at all. Climate groups say this is an abdication of responsibility, with Americans feeling the effects of a warming planet more than ever. The recently passed Inflation Reduction Act, the so-called most significant climate legislation in US history, does very little to address the food system. Jesse Silverman, a senior policy associate for the Center for Science in the Public Interest, said, "Climate change poses a multitude of threats to human health and nutrition security. We cannot extricate these things from each other." Her group and 39 others, including the Union of Concerned Scientists and the American Academy of Pediatrics, in May, wrote a letter urging the US government to include sustainability in the 2025-2030 dietary guidelines, which are now in development. A sustainability component would encourage Americans to eat less meat and dairy products, which have a significant higher climate impact than nutritionally comparable plant-based foods. Another signatory to the letter, Mark Rifkin, senior food and agriculture policy specialist for the Center for Biological Diversity, said, "It will be virtually impossible to even meet the 2 degrees Celsius limit in global temperature change without incorporating substantial reductions in beef intake." Walter Willett, a professor at Harvard University's School of Public Health, said the current guidelines advise Americans to eat far more animal products than is sustainable. The primary dietary chart recommends 26 ounces of protein from meat, poultry, and eggs a week, compared with just 5 ounces from plant-based foods, although there are alternative charts that show how vegetarians can get the same nutrients without meat. He said they also still basically say 3 servings of dairy products a day, which is actually really radical because our current consumption is 1.6 servings a day, adding, "To just recommend 3 servings of dairy products and say nothing about the environmental consequences if people really did that, is just completely irresponsible. Because most Americans are deficient in fiber and fruits and vegetables, not animal products," Mark Rifkin, a dietitian, said, "climate-focused guidance would line up with what the public needs nutritionally." He said it would also help address other problems that stem from the meat-heavy US food system, including risk of future pandemics, food security and pollution from concentrated animal feeding operations, which disproportionately affect communities of color. A proposed list of questions released in April for the scientific panel that advises the guidelines didn't include sustainability. That worries advocates, but they say it's still early. Janet DeJesus, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services staff lead on the guidelines, said sustainability could still be included. DeJesus said, "We're not saying that it's not going to be in the dietary guidelines. We're not saying that at all." She added, "It's a high priority for the Health and Human Services leadership to address climate change." According to a United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization FAO report, countries including Germany, Brazil, Sweden and Qatar have addressed sustainability in their dietary guidelines. Canada's Food Guide advises choosing plant-based foods more often for the environment. Vox reported recently Germany has cut its per capita meat consumption by 12% since 2011, and its Minister of Food and Agriculture has recently prioritized a shift towards more plant-based eating. Advocates say a change in the U.S. dietary guidelines could have a similar influence. Jesse Silverman says, "The guidelines are much more impactful than I think a lot of people realize. Federal food aid programs have to comply with the guidelines, shaping how millions of people eat. For instance, the National School Lunch and National School Breakfast programs claim they served more than 7 billion meals a year to tens of millions of children before the COVID-19 pandemic. The guidelines also influence cafeteria foods served in government buildings, hospitals and other institutions, and are used in nutrition education programs. According to a recent paper in Communications, Earth and Environment, national school lunches reach makes it uniquely positioned to affect the dietary patterns of American children and adolescents and could aid in addressing the environmental impacts of food systems. Meat contributes disproportionately to school meals' impact on the climate, as well as land and water use. Because U.S. government programs and other large institutions claim they serve so many meals, sustainability advocates in recent years have focused on trying to influence their food buying decisions. California earlier this year allowed $100 million to help schools serve more plant-based meals. This isn't the first time the environment has been at issue in the nation's dietary guidelines. In 2015, a panel of nutrition experts that advised the 2015 through to 2020 guidelines addressed sustainability in its scientific report. The panel wrote, "In general, a dietary pattern that is higher in plant-based foods such as vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lower in animal-based foods is more healthy and it should be promoted and is associated with lesser environmental impact. But after outcry from the meat industry and US Republican lawmakers, the recommendation to eat more plants was dropped from the final guidelines. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal at the time, the U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said sustainability was outside the purview of the dietary guidelines and compared the scientific committee to his granddaughter, whose colors outside of the lines. Bob Martin of the John Hopkins Center for a Livable Future said about Tom Vilsack's comments, "It's really condescending stuff. The people involved in this were highly qualified." Agribusiness has a long history of influence over the dietary guidelines, and it will undoubtedly be a factor this time around as well. The meat and dairy industries spent $49.5 million on political contributions in 2020 and another $15.9 million lobbying the federal government. Food industry groups also routinely report lobbying on federal nutrition policy, According to federal lobbying records, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, between 2014 and 2016, spent more than $303,000 lobbying to keep beef in the dietary guidelines. Several industry groups, including the North American Meat Institute, the National Dairy Foods Association, and the National Turkey Federation, have already weighed in on the process for the 2025 through to 2030 guidance. The National Pork Producers Council wrote in a public comment in May, "While an important topic, sustainability is outside of the scope of the dietary guidelines." Jesse Silverman of the Center for Science in the Public Interest said, "Even though environmental advocates face an uphill battle, a lot has changed since the failed 2015 effort to incorporate sustainability." She added, "I think the public pressure to have concrete policies to address climate change has grown a lot in the years since then."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on July 27, 2022.
As for the position that the Friday prayers hold, let me tell you in one word that the Friday prayer is a totally unique religious duty and there is nothing like it. One feature is that the Friday prayer connects and ties together two essential factors that are part of a pure life. What are these two factors? One is the remembrance of God, dhikr. The other is the presence of the people. We shall reward him with a good life. Quran, Surah 16, verse 97. Now, the good life has pillars. These two pillars, however, are among its most important pillars. One is to turn your attention toward God, the aspect that religious scholars call being in contact with God. The other aspect is the gathering and presence of the people. These two aspects exist together in the Friday prayers. This is also the case in some other obligations and religious duties, but when we add the rest of the features to it, we see that the Friday prayer is exceptional. So, as I mentioned, these two characteristics exist together in the Friday prayer. We have both, O you who have faith, and hurry towards the remembrance of Allah. The Quran, Surah 62, verse number 9. It's both prayer and it's a Jumu'ah. Prayer is pure remembrance of God, and Jumu'ah is the gathering of people. That is, this is one of those features, and perhaps it is the first special feature of the Friday prayer. Secondly, this collective remembrance of God allows the blessings and effects of the dhikr to descend upon the people. The remembrance of Allah has effects, which have been referred to in the Quran. The hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance. The Quran, Surah 13, verse 28. This is spread throughout the Friday prayer, when everyone remembers Allah together. At one time, remembering the noble verse, "Hold fast all together to Allah's cord and do not be divided." Quran, Surah 3, verse 103.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I mentioned that even holding fast to God's court must be done all together. Hold fast all together to Allah's court. We all have to hold fast to God's court together. This gathering in Islam is something extraordinary. The community spirit and presence of the people is an important matter. This is where you need to be careful. If, for example, your Friday prayer this week has fewer attendees than last month's Friday prayer, you should be worried.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Hundreds of people attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip in a move to express their sympathy and unity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails and detention centers. They came to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners who kicked off a series of protests last Monday against persistent mistreatment inside regime jails. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with Palestinian detainees. During the Friday sermon, Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against harming Palestinian prisoners.
Our military wings, including the Qassam and Quds brigades, and the military wings of all Palestinian resistance factions, are all united behind the prisoners. We will spare no effort to secure the release of the prisoners. Harming Palestinian prisoners is an attack on all Palestinian resistance factions.
Over the past 4 days, Palestinian detainees held in 24 Israeli prisons have refused to take part in security checks and returned their meals. They also organized sit-ins in prison yards as part of their protest action.
The Israeli prison service reneged on understandings that were previously reached with prisoners' representatives. It imposed punitive measures, including moving tens of detainees to solitary confinement, preventing inmates from going to the prison yard, and banning prisoners from meeting their families. In response to this, the Palestinian prisoners have declared the state of general mobilization last Monday.
In recent weeks, the Israeli prison service increased its oppressive measures against Palestinian prisoners by imposing double isolation on some detainees. Observers say the Palestinian prisoners have become propaganda material for candidates in Israel's elections.
Palestinian prisoners are escalating their actions because they demand better detention conditions. The suffering of Palestinian prisoners increases every time the Israeli regime plans to hold elections. Israeli officials are using the oppression of prisoners as part of their election campaigns.
Currently, there are some 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, and that figure includes women and children. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has detained more than 1 million Palestinians since the Nakba in 1948, under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Thank you.
If you're a British citizen waiting for a package to be delivered by Royal Mail, expect a delay. More than 100,000 of the company's workers, hailed as heroes for working through the pandemic, have walked out of the job to fight for a wage rise amid a deepening cost of living crisis.
To come into this action, to get your members motivated.
We didn't create this crisis. The oligarchs in every society, the people that are taking dividends and profits, feeding their own fat tummies and making our people wait for a decent pay rise. That's what's causing inflation. But it's also what's causing bitterness between the classes. Now, we've got to make sure that we rebalance that equation.
The bosses at Royal Mail, a 500-year-old multinational, now privatized postal service, claims the Communication Workers Union, which represents these strikers, has rejected a pay rise offer worth up to more than 5% after 3 months of talks. The union's leader says that's simply not true.
The reason why it's a lie is because it doesn't exist. It's a total fabrication, and it's being spun to the media, embarrassingly, really, to try and make the company look as though they're being reasonable when what they're actually doing is just disgraceful. So the real situation is that the company made £758 million profit. The company gave away over £400 million to major shareholders and then imposed a 2% pay increase to the workforce.
The walkout is being described as the biggest industrial action of the summer so far, which has already seen workers strike across the railways, ports and the courts. They all come at a time when the UK is grappling with its highest inflation rate and soaring energy prices in decades.
Today's strike action is the opening salvo in a dispute that could reshape a British institution. And the strikers tell us that they're in it for the long haul. Saeed Purizza, London.
Yuan has held an automotive exhibition titled The New Era of Yuan's Automotive Industry. The event provides an opportunity for auto parts manufacturers and automakers to establish better bonds and meet the needs of the industry and the market through joint cooperation.
We have plans to reform the structure of our automotive industry as well as the relations between auto parts manufacturers and automakers. Moreover, under the plan, the overall promised production target will be achieved in 2025.
According to a report released by the International Organization of Motor Vehicle Manufacturers, OICA, Yuan has been ranked the world's 19th biggest automaker in 2021. Based on the OICA data, Iranian automakers produced almost 900,000 vehicles in 2021. That marked a 2% increase compared to 2020.
We have done a lot of work in the automotive industry, but there is still much to do. A car has more than 2,000 parts, and every day 4,000 cars are produced in the country. We do not have any other industries with such managerial, economic, and technological complexities.
The Iranian manufacturers currently produce 6 different types of vehicles, including passenger cars, 4WD trucks, buses, minibuses, and pickup trucks. The sector has directly employed about 500,000 people and many more in related industries. About 75% of local output is passenger cars, while pickups come in the second place with around 15%.
The auto industry is a key driving force in Iran, the operation and prosperity of which keeps almost 60 other industries moving. The industry is only second to its energy sector, accounting for almost 10% of the gross domestic product. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Last year, when U.S. military forces were withdrawing from Afghanistan, thousands of foreign and Afghan citizens were also trying to get out of the country. In those days, thousands of people gathered outside the airport in the hope that they can go inside and catch a flight out. But American and NATO forces failed to control the situation, and then came a disaster. This side of the canal is where U.S. soldiers were standing, using the barbed wire not to let people pass. And this canal is where people were trying to pass and get over the ridge. The explosion also killed plus 183 persons.
I saw people, including women and children, who were running. There were people carrying the wounded with wheelbarrow. Many of the dead and wounded people were thrown into the canal. Women were running and screaming, trying to get to the hospital. We were so close, so we went there and did what we could do to help them.
It was around 6 p.m. when a suicide bomber entered a crowd of disturbed people and detonated his vest just outside the international airport of Kabul on August 26th last year. At least